Hosea chapter 2, verses 14 to chapter 3, verses 5. Therefore I'm now going to allure her. I will lead her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. There I will give her back her vineyards and will make the valley of Achorah a door of hope. There she will respond as in the days of her youth, as in the day she came up out of Egypt. In that day, declares the Lord, you will call me my husband, and you will no longer call me my master. I will remove the names of the vows from her lips. No longer will their names be invoked. In that day I will make a covenant for them with the beasts of the field, the birds in the sky, and the creatures that move along the ground. Bow and sword and battle I will abolish from the land, so that all may lie down in safety. I will betroth you to me forever. I will betroth you in righteousness and justice, in love and compassion. I will betroth you in faithfulness, and you will acknowledge the Lord. In that day I will respond, declares the Lord. I will respond to the skies, and they will respond to the earth, and the earth will respond to the grain, the new wine and the olive oil, and they will respond to Jezreel. I will plant her for myself in the land. I will show my love to the one I called, not my loved one. I will say to those called, not my people, you are my people. And they will say, you are my God. The Lord said to me, go, show your love to your wife again, though she is loved by another man and is in adulteress. Love her as the Lord loves the Israelites, though they turn to other gods and love the sacred raisin cakes. So I bought her for 15 shekels of silver and about a homer and a thek of barley. And then I told her, you are to live with me many days. You must not be a prostitute or be intimate with any man, and I will behave the same way toward you. For the Israelites will live many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred stones, without ephod or household gods. Afterward, the Israelites will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king. They will come trembling to the Lord and to the blessings in the last days. Thanks be to God.
Thanks be to God. Thanks, Jeffrey. Good afternoon, everyone. Can I extend my welcome to you as well. Great to see you, whether you're joining us here or online. Please do keep that passage open in your Connect bulletin or if you have the Bible in front of you. You know, when it comes to marriages, Hollywood films tend to end with marriages and not begin with them. They tell the story normally of how a couple end up walking up the aisle, not what happens afterwards. But the film, The Painted Veil, is different. It's not the story of boy meets girl and they fall in love and then get married. Instead, it begins with a wedding, and then through staying together, they fall in love. The film is set in 1927, and it begins with the wedding of Kitty and Walter. Kitty is a bored and spoilt London socialite, and she marries Walter to escape her horrid mother. Walter is a bacteriologist, and shortly after they get married, his work takes them to China, where Kitty soon begins an affair with this sleazy diplomat called Charlie. When Walter finds out about this affair, he gives Kitty an ultimatum. Either she marries Charlie or she goes with him, Walter, to a remote region that's suffering from a cholera outbreak. The film suggests that Walter is so bitter at her betrayal that there is a desire for her to die. I mean, after all, why would he take her with him to this infested cholera place? Now, through the movie, there's hostility in the relationship, and that grows to the point where Kitty, who is lonely and feeling marooned in this isolated community, pleads with Walter to forgive her, to stop punishing her. She says to him, why is it that you despise me so much? Walter says, it's myself I despise for falling in love with you. Here, behind this cool facade of a doctor, is a man nursing a broken heart. Now, if you were in Walter's situation, how would you respond to this betrayal? We're in a series looking at the book of Hosea. It's a love story about romance and desire, heartbreak and betrayal. And what's shocking at the beginning of this story is that God asks Hosea the prophet to marry an adulterous woman. But Hosea's relationship with his wife is a pale reflection to God's relationship with his people. Here are people who he has loved and protected and provided for. He saved them, but they spurn his love. They wander after other gods and they reject him. But the thing is, in this story of God's relationship with his people is also our story. Because you and I are intimately involved. Our human character has remained utterly unchanged throughout the centuries. And the Bible talks about how all of us commonly wander away from the God who has created us and we spurn his love. We give our hearts to other things. Our rejection of God is personal. And so Hosea says God is not a detached bystander, rather he is a wounded husband who pays an incredible cost to get us back. And so as we look at this passage, we'll see three things: a renewed love, a renewed marriage, and thirdly, the cost of that love. Our passage today begins halfway through chapter 2 with that word, therefore. That means a transition is about to happen, a sudden change compared to what's happened before. Now, so far in the story, we've been told about Israel's unfaithfulness, her spiritual adultery. In chapter 1 that we looked at last week, Hosea, his wife, bears some children, but they're to another man. And God tells Hosea to name these children Lo Ruhamah, which means not loved, and Lo Ami, which means not my people. In other words, this is God's way of expressing his deep grief over Israel's spiritual adultery. They're not loved, they're not my people. But then this expression of grief and despondency spills over into chapter 2. So in verse 2, God says, rebuke your mother, rebuke her, for she is not my wife, and I'm not her husband. Let her remove the adulterous look from her face. Or in verse 13, I will punish her for the days she burned incense to the Baals. She decked herself with rings and jewelry and went after her lovers, but me she forgot, says the Lord. Now remember, this is years before the Assyrians, who are the local superpower of the time, invade the northern kingdom of Israel. And Hosea sees that this is coming. He knows that what is going to come. But for him, what happens is not the cause of geopolitical or historical manifestations. To him, Israel's exile, her conquest by Assyria, has fundamentally theological causes. It's not just about big nation conquering and swallowing up smaller nation. It's about Israel's rejection of their God. They're chasing after other idols and therefore God punishing them. Now, if this is the story so far, we're supposed to ask, what comes after this word? Israel, you've been spiritually adulterous, unfaithful, therefore, it's over. I cannot forgive you, I'm hurt too much. Therefore, we're done. I cannot love you, a whole relationship is over, we're finished. I do not want to see you again. That, after all, would be the natural response, the normal response, wouldn't it, of a wounded lover? But that's not what happens. Instead, we see, therefore, I'm going to allure her. Therefore, I'm going to win her back. I'm going to love her again. I'm going to rebuild the relationship. I'm going to bring us together again. It's incredible. It's stunning. Here is a renewal of love, God giving his people something they do not deserve. We read further on, therefore, I'm now going to allure her. I will lead her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. There, I'll give back her vineyards and I'll make the valley of Achor a door of hope. There she will respond as in the days of her youth, as in the day she came up out of Egypt. Imagine a husband who realizes his marriage is on the rocks. And in order to rescue that marriage just before it gets to the breaking point, he takes his wife to the place where they first met and fell in love, in the hope that she will remember why she fell in love with him and that old love would be rekindled. That's what is happening in these verses. God had rescued his people out of slavery in Egypt, and he takes them through the wilderness to Mount Sinai, where he makes a covenant with them. It's like he gets married with them at that point. And not just that, in the wilderness was the place of God's provision and protection upon them. He gave them bread in the desert, water from a rock. It's there where they were tested and tried, where they put aside the fertility gods of Egypt and learned to love him. They gave their heart to him. And Hosea is saying, in this exile will be again a time of wilderness, where God's people will put aside their idols and learn to love him again. Now, you and I, we should not be unmoved by God's renewal of his love. When he says, I'm going to allure her, it's not like he's going to use some cheap chat-up lines on a girl at a nightclub. He's speaking about his affections in talking to someone he has deep feelings for. And remember who it is that he's speaking to. He's not speaking to some dazzling girl he's just met. He's speaking to his cheating ex. He's not asking for the love of a princess, but of a prostitute, the one who has spurned his love over and over and over again. He wants to speak tenderly to her. That word in verse 14 literally means speak to her heart. Now, you and I have things that speak to our heart all the time. There are things in our lives, something or someone that we prize and we value so much, and whatever it is that's in that position will speak to your heart, whether it's your wallet, your reputation, your looks, your security, your comfort, your spouse, your family. That will take priority of place in your heart. And you'll do anything for it. That thing will give you joy and anxiety. It'll make demands of you. And you'll chase after it and serve whatever it is that has the priority of place in your hearts. But God is saying, I'm supposed to have that priority of place. All of us have things which compete with God for our affections, that capture our attention. Now, it's good to love the things that God gives us, but if we're God's people, then he is supposed to be the one who speaks most tenderly to our hearts, the one who we think most about. Now, practically speaking for a moment, the way this happens for us is through praise. You know, God speaks most tenderly to our hearts when we enumerate his glories, when we think and we list and remind ourselves about who he is and what he has done for us, because praise is linked with love. And that's how we have our hearts spoken tenderly to. Some of you may have heard of the film Groundhog Day. It's the story of Bill Murray's character who's condemned to live the same day over and over and over again. It just repeats itself. And during the movie, he falls in love with Andy McDowell's character. And because he lives each day over and over and over again, he sees everything about her. That's how he falls in love. He becomes besotted with her, even though she doesn't know what's going on. And there's a point in the movie in which he declares his love for her, and she says, how do you love me? You don't know anything about me. And he looks at her and he says, I know all about you. You like boats, but not the ocean. You go to a lake in the summer in the mountains. You're a sucker for French poetry and rhinestones. You're very generous. You're kind to strangers and children. And when you stand in the snow, you look like an angel. It's captivating. Because he doesn't just say, I love you. He lists the reasons why. And as he talks about all the things that he finds captivating about her, you can tell his heart grows. That's praise. And so it should be with God. We don't just say to God, God, you're so great. No, we go through the reasons. God, your love for me is awesome. You shower upon me an undeserving, unremitting, unconditional love. You know everything about me, all my flaws, all my secrets, and yet you still love me and you pursue me and you come after me. That's what it means to speak tenderly to your heart. To go through the list of God's character, what he has done for you. And the more and more that you do that, the more you find that all those other things which compete with God for your affections loosen their grip on your heart. And your love for God renews over and over and over again. So we have a renewed love, but secondly, we have a renewed marriage. Now, if you're new to Christianity here, throughout the Bible, God's relationship with his people is described in different ways. So God relates to his people, for instance, like a king relates to his subjects, or a shepherd relates to sheep, or a father relates to his children. But in marriage, also how a husband relates to his wife. And you see it in this passage, because from verses 19 to 20, three times God says, I will betroth you. I will betroth you, I will betroth you, I will betroth you. And this is stunning. Because far from God abandoning his marriage with his people because of their spiritual unfaithfulness, he renews the marriage. And this is not just some weary sorting out of differences, and it goes beyond the alluring words, the speaking tenderly. Here is a completely new beginning. And you know, you will never really understand God and how he relates to you and how you're supposed to relate to him unless you understand your relationship with him in terms of a marriage. Because a marriage has two aspects that are absolutely vital. It's the most intimate and the most important of relationships. There's intimacy and there's priority. So we see the intimacy in verse 16. In that day, declares the Lord, you will call me my husband, you will no longer call me my master. We cannot quite see it here, but there is a play on words. The sentence should mean, you will call me my husband, you will no longer call me my Baal. Baal was a generic word that was used for gods. And in the Israelite context, it was a particular word to describe the Canaanite gods, but could also be used to describe boss or owner or master. Here, God is saying to his people, I do not want you to call me the same thing that you call those other idols. I don't even want you to be thinking about those other idols when you're talking with me. I want you to call me my husband. Rather than using a formal term, owner or boss or master or even Lord, here is a term of affection, intimacy, exclusivity. You could call me my husband. But it goes further on. Rather than seeing the incredible statement of disenfranchisement, of estrangement, of hostility and bitterness that we saw in chapter 1, God says in verse 23, I will show my love to the one I called not my love. I will say to those called not my people, you are my people. It's like God is saying, I'm yours and you are mine. You know, a human marriage is the most intimate of relationships. And in one sense, that's because no one knows you better than your spouse. You can keep all sorts of things hidden from other people, but it's hard to keep everything hidden from your spouse. But in another sense, also because of the deep passion that there should exist in that relationship. And when God says to us, I've betrothed you, I've covenanted with you, he's saying, don't be distant with me. Don't treat me in a hands-off fashion, in a mere formal sense. I know everything about you. I know what ticks. I know all those things that you try to keep hidden from other people. I know your worries and anxieties. I know your joys and what makes you happy. And I want to be with you through thick and thin. This is the most intimate of relationships. But also, it's a relationship of priority. Verse 17, God says, I'll remove the names of the Baals from her lips. No longer will their names be invoked. To have the names of Baals on your lips means the Baals are most important. To invoke someone's name means to both worship that person, but also to come to that person in your time of need. Now, this happens to us all the time. If you love someone and you delight in them, then you want to be speaking about them all the time. Their names will be on your lips. Or if you're anxious and fearful, then you cry out to the person who you think will be able to help you. You'll invoke their name. Whoever we find most important in our lives, we want to be able to connect with them all the time. And God is saying to his people, the names of the Baals shouldn't be on your lips. It should be my name. They're not the ones who delight in you and love you. I am. They're not the ones who provide for you and protect you. I am. They shouldn't be your first priority. I should. Then further down in verse 20, God says, I will betroth you in faithfulness and you will acknowledge the Lord. That term for acknowledgement isn't just merely recognizing someone. Hello, nice to meet you. It is that, but it goes far beyond that. Because God betroths himself, he binds himself with his people, to acknowledge means to recognize his place, the priority of place he should have in your life. Now, there is nothing more important in our human relationships than a married relationship. Everything else comes second. You know, if you have a strong marriage, you put priority on your marriage and you have a strong marriage, then even if the rest of your life is a mess, you'll be okay. But if your marriage is weak, you know, you could have lots of things going well for you in life, but you can't really go out into the world in strength because that foundational relationship is not going well. It is so vital that it affects everything else. God says to us, I'm your husband. I'm your ultimate priority. You know, do not have me as an add-on to your life, someone to help you to get to wherever it is you want to go in life. No, I'm the one who travels with you through good times and bad. I'm the one non-negotiable aspect of your life. I'm your first priority. And so here we have Hosea describing for us the relationship that God wants with each of us. A relationship of intimacy and priority where he is ours and we are his. Where even the best moments in the best human relationships are just a dim hint of God's love for us. And so how do we get this kind of relationship? How do we get this love? Well, it's because of the cost that God pays for us. Chapter 3, verse 1. The Lord said to me, go, show your love to your wife again, though she is loved by another man and is an adulteress. Love her as the Lord loves the Israelites, though they turn to other gods. Here, the focus now turns to Hosea's relationship with his wife, Gomer. But God's relationship with his people is still there in the picture. Because what happens in chapter 3 is an enacted parable, an illustration explaining how chapter 2 will happen, how God will win back his people. By this stage, Hosea and Gomer are separated. It's years after their marriage and she has moved out, probably with one of her lovers. And Hosea might be thinking, I'm glad I've seen the end of her. But God says to him, go and find her, even though she's with another guy. Now think of her situation. She is socially ruined because in ancient times, people would know that she's been with a man after man after man. She would have a reputation. And she's financially ruined. Because we're told that Hosea doesn't just have to go and find her, he has to buy her. Perhaps she's landed in debt and has had to sell herself into some sort of indentured slavery. She's financially ruined. And so you can imagine the situation. Gomer's master has a visitor. And she can hear them talking in the next room, but the voice sounds familiar. Hang on. Isn't that Hosea? What's Hosea doing here? Has he come to gloat over me, to laugh at my ruin? And she tries to get closer to hear what's happening in the next room. And she can hear them haggling over something. They're haggling over a price for her. 8 shekels, 10, 12, 15 shekels of silver and some barley. That's the price. And she thinks to herself, hang on, Hosea's bought me. He's bought me for that much. How could he want me? I'm old and ruined. And probably her first reaction is, well, he's doing this for revenge. He just wants to gloat over me. He wants to have me for himself. I go from being one guy's slave to his slave. But that's not what happens. Because in verse 3 we read, you are to live with me many days. You must not be a prostitute or be intimate with any other man, and I'll behave the same with you. Hosea is saying, I don't want you to be my slave. I want you to be my wife. I'm going to love you. We're going to rebuild our lives together. We're going to rebuild a home. And he goes further because he says something that seems a little bit cryptic here. He's saying, I don't want you to be with another man. I don't want you to continue your adultery. But we're not going to sleep together either for a while. But then we'll be together. Now, what he seems to be doing here is doing the deep emotional work of healing and forgiveness. Hosea is not naive, thinking that everything will be easy and patched up lightly. No, they've got to do the hard work of figuring out all their differences, of looking at what's happened. She's got to put away her old habits of adultery, and they've got to learn to come together and love each other. And I think that's why Hosea speaks in verses 4 and 5 about Israel. They go into exile, and there will be a time where they will live for days without king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred stones, without ephod or household gods. In exile in the wilderness, they'll be without all of those things that they chased after more than God. In exile, they'll have to put away all their bad adulterous habits and learn once again what it looks like to love God. And if I might pause here just for a moment before I move on, you and I need to learn to do the same things. All of us have idols in our hearts. If you spend enough time observing your own life and figuring out what brings you joy, what brings you anxiety, what you spend most of your time thinking about, you'll find those thoughts quickly turn to your idols, those things that you prioritize ahead of God. And even though your life might look incredibly functional on the surface, it doesn't look like Gomer's. All of us have to do the heart work of looking to those things that we pursue more than God and learning to put them away and love God more. Hosea moves on. He says afterwards in verse 5, the Israelites will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king. They will come trembling to the Lord and to his blessings in the last days. Hosea can see what is coming. The Israelites will go off into exile, but there will be a day where they'll seek the Lord and they'll come back to God and to David, their king. Now, David, the king, has been long dead. So who's he talking about? Well, he's talking about the long-expected king, the one who was promised to David who will rule forever, the one who will redeem his people and save them from their sins. Do you see how much it cost Hosea to win back his wife? Do you see how much it cost God to win his people back? It cost Hosea some silver and grain. It cost God his son, Jesus, the one who was from the line of David. Jesus, the one who means God saves. The Apostle Peter said, for you know that it is not with perishable things such as silver or gold that you're redeemed from the empty way of life handed to you from your ancestors, but it was with the precious blood of Christ, a lamb without blemish or defects. As I finish, let me ask you two questions. First, are you unsure about God's love for you? You know, maybe you recognize that you have a lot of skeletons in the closet, a lot of things that you try to keep hidden from people, a lot of things that you're not pleased about. And you're thinking to yourself, how could God love me with all of this, with all of this baggage? How could I possibly forgive him? I keep making mistakes. I keep failing. How could God love me? Well, the story of Hosea and the story of the gospel is a demonstration of what God will do to win you back. The extent of his love for you can be seen in the extent of what it cost him to win you back. It cost him his son. Second question, has this costly love transformed your life? You know, we are shaped most by those things that we love the most. You will find it easier to serve those around you when you see how much God has served you. You'll find it easier to forgive and show grace to others when you see how much God has shown grace and forgiven you. You'll find delight and fulfillment in his love when you see how much God delights in love with you. You'll find peace and security in uncertain times in this uncertain world when you place your peace and security in Jesus. Give your heart to him. This is the love that you've been looking for your entire life. A love that will not let you down or abandon you. A love that has cost everything. Give your heart to him. Let's pray. Lord God, when we look at this old, old story, we cannot help but be stunned by your extravagant love. A love that takes the initiative in pursuing us, even though we do not deserve it. A love that is unrelenting, unconditional, extravagant in giving up his son for us. Lord, thank you for the love that you have shown us in your son Jesus. We need your help, not just to ponder and reflect upon this love, but to give our hearts to you. So guide us by your Spirit, Lord. Remind us of the cross, that incredible example, the ultimate example of your love for us. And help us to give our lives for you. Help us to live, transform lives because of what you have done for us in Jesus. And we ask these things in his name. Amen. Give you a few moments of quiet reflection, prayer, maybe confession, then we're going to respond in song.